Truth and Justice is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are all things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Cars today are built to last, but how they look is up to you, and that's where Maaco comes in. They specialize in cosmetic repairs. Let's say it's affordable paint jobs to fixing those annoying dents and dings. Whatever it is, Maaco has you covered. With more Americans keeping their cars longer, now's the time to protect your investment and keep it looking sharp for years. Get started. Visit your local Maaco today. Get the free estimate and see how easy it is to bring new life to your ride. Uh-oh, better get Maaco.
Anything to lose. I have no secrets to hide. I could just be blunt and people could judge it however they judge it.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Demario Lowes was not killed at 12:40 a.m. Let me repeat that again so that there's no ambiguity. Demario Lowes was not murdered at 12:40 a.m. This is not my opinion. This is not the conclusion of my personal analysis. This is a fact. Last week, I promised to explain to you how Jody Hill was convicted in this episode. And if you were listening closely, then you know that that's a valid question. All evidence seems to indicate that Jody was clearly alibied during the time of the murder. Jody was at work until at least 12:05 a.m., then got a ride home from their co-worker, Cornelius. And Cornelius testified that he and Jody talked for about 20 minutes after they got to the apartment before Cornelius left. At that point, Jody went inside, they argued with their girlfriend, and they went to bed. All of which was confirmed by Sherelle Moore, who also testified that her mother and children verified that Jody never left the house that night. So again, the obvious question. How did Jody get convicted of murdering a man who was killed while they were obviously alibied? The answer to that question is multi-layered. There were two key elements to the state's case that were very obvious. One of which we'll be discussing today, along with another less obvious element that everyone seemed to have missed. The thing that we've been discussing for 2 weeks. The shift in the timing of the murder and the whitewashing of Jody's alibi from work. I told you last week that McGinnis knew within hours of Mario's murder that Jody could not be responsible. At that point, he knew what time the killing occurred, and the police were at the cafe where Jody worked that very next morning. Investigators were told that Jody worked very late that night, and they collected their timesheet as evidence just a few days later. Also, on that same morning, McGinnis interviewed Sherelle Moore, who told him that when Jody got home from work, they went to sleep, and she went out to the club, and when she returned, Jody was still in bed sleeping. Jody Hill should never have even been a suspect in this case. Alibis do not get much more solid than that. But then came the chess match that landed Jody in prison for the rest of their life. These are the steps that were taken to undo Jody's alibi. First, and really the most alarming, McGinnis removed any and all mention of Diallo's Cafe and the timesheet from the murder book. Anyone reviewing it would have no idea at all that LaShawn Harper was spoken to or that the timesheet was collected as evidence, like it never happened. And by doing that, McGinnis created some wiggle room in his timeline. Sure, Jody was at work, but who knew what time they got off? By the time the trial came around, a year later, no one did. Too much time had passed, and they no longer had the timesheet to reference because the police had taken it. That was step one. Step two was to get Jody home and available to commit the murder by 11 p.m. That part was easy. Sherelle Moore was interviewed, and McGinnis just wrote in his report that she said Jody was home from work by 11 o'clock. Now, Sherelle says that's a lie, and that is not what she said. But really, we'll never know because we have no recording of the interview. Another move in the chess match. What we do know is that Jody most certainly was not home until well after midnight, because the one solid anchor that we have is the timesheet. So I see no reason to believe that Sherelle would have been 2 hours off in her timing the very next morning. The pieces continue to move around the board as McGinnis fails to note in his report that Sherelle's handicapped mother and children were home all night with Jody. So he created a case file that made it appear as though Jody was home no later than 11 o'clock and that no one could account for their whereabouts from 11 to 3. And keep in mind, no one knows this is happening. It's not like Sherelle or LaShawn or Kenya or anyone else got to see what McGinnis was writing in his reports. He conducted his interviews, gathered his evidence, and then created a fairy tale of a murder book that made it look like Jody was a viable suspect. And he didn't stop there. The witnesses that were interviewed didn't know what McGinnis was writing in those reports. But at the same time, he also knew that in reality, Jody was at work until at least 12:05. And he couldn't count on no one actually remembering the correct times or producing evidence that they were at work for an hour or two longer than his murder book suggested. McGinnis needed some insurance. He needed the time of the murder to be late enough that even if the timesheet evidence came to light, there would still be enough time for Jody to have killed Mario after work. And how did he get that insurance? It was simple. Just say the murder happened at 12:40. First, let me quickly prove to you that Mario was not killed at 12:40 once and for all. I've already made most of the case on the subject over the last 2 weeks, but there's more. Listener Wendell Mass was able to put a few pieces of the puzzle together for us. He started tracking the order of events from the police reports that I posted so far on our website, and he caught something that I had missed. We know that Detective McKinney documented in his report that he interviewed Victoria Miles at 12:30 a.m. And I mentioned last week that it's possible this was a typo, but also that it fit with both Victoria and James Blackwell's statements about hearing the shots at around 11:45. What Wendell noticed was that McKinney also documented when he was called to the scene. From his report, quote, "On November 16, 2001, at 0:00 hours, I, Detective McKinney, received a telephone call at my residence from Dispatcher Hoyle, who advised there had been a homicide that had just occurred at 784 Broadway Street in the city of Benton Harbor, Michigan. Dispatcher Hoyle stated that Sergeant London needed assistance and requested for me to meet with him on the scene." End quote. It seems less and less likely that the 12:30 interview with Miles was a typo. It tracks perfectly with the time that McKinney says he was dispatched to the scene. He got called in at midnight, and the dispatcher told him that the homicide had, quote, "just occurred," which again fits with the witnesses saying that it happened at 11:45. But as you read through his narrative, the puzzle pieces start to come together. McKinney was the first detective called to the scene by Sergeant London. McGinnis was not there at that point. McKinney says that he was briefed by London, who informed him that the red hatchback in the parking area was the same one involved in the armed robbery a few days before. London was the officer who caught Leon Newcomb when he was running away from that incident. McKinney then interviewed some people on the scene and then went upstairs to interview Victoria Miles at 12:30. McGinnis is still not there at this point, and that's important because the one time that appears to be confirmed and accurate in this case file is that dispatch announced on the radio that they tried calling McGinnis at 12:51 a.m. Now I'm about to read to you a pretty confusing section of the trial transcript. It's from McGinnis's testimony. What's happening here is that the prosecutor wants to play the dispatch tape in its entirety from the beginning of Victoria Miles' 911 call through the point where dispatch announces that they called McGinnis and declared that it's 12:51 a.m. Like I said, the entire situation is odd. First of all, dispatch was not successful in getting McGinnis on the phone that night, and Officer Abdullah had to physically go to his house to notify McGinnis of the request for him to respond to the scene. But also, Victoria Miles was not the first 911 call. Cotter, the prosecutor, uses this tape to establish that the murder occurred at 12:40. And Ernie White, the defense attorney, drops the ball here in spectacular fashion. First and foremost, as you'll hear in the testimony, White has never heard this tape before. And secondly, at the end of the exchange, he stipulates to the fact that the first 911 call came in at 12:40, when that is literally impossible. Not only, again, was Victoria's not the first call, also the timing proves that the call could not have came in at 12:40. As I read this exchange to you, pay attention to the times. The tape, unfortunately, isn't transcribed, but we do know how long it played. It plays for 12 full minutes before White stops the tape. At that point, we have still not gotten to the part where the McGinnis call happens at 12:51. So, do the math. 12:51 minus 12 minutes is 12:39. That means, at the very latest, Victoria's call could not have happened until 12:39. And that's if the McGinnis call was just seconds after the tape stopped. We actually have no idea how much longer the tape needed to play to get to 12:51. It could have been 30 more minutes for all we know. Here's the exchange from the transcript. Cotter: at this time, Your Honor, I'm going to play the tape first of the homicide. The judge: all right, so this first recording is a tape on November 16, 2001. And notice here how Cotter doesn't answer that question. Because remember, if this happened prior to midnight, it was actually November 15th. So Cotter's response to, is it the one from November 16, 2001, is from the Benton Harbor Police Department recorded dispatch and calls line. The judge: is that correct, officer? McGinnis: yes, it is. Judge: all right, go ahead. At 11:10 a.m., audio tape played into the record, not transcribed. At 11:22 a.m., audio tape playing interrupted. Mr. White: Your Honor, I would like to interrupt at this point. The court: fine, stop the tape. At 11:22 a.m., audio tape stopped. The judge: Mr. White, do you have an objection? White: if this is for the purpose of the 911 call, we're well beyond that. We're into chit-chat between the police over the radio. I don't know what's going to be said or not said, but it's well beyond the 911 call. Cotter: the dispatcher gives, and the only reason why I'm continuing with this, judge, the dispatcher gives the time that they called Detective McGinnis, and this is in real time. So the jury is going to have a sense of the time the first dispatch call came into the time that they called Detective McGinnis, and it's indicated on the tape that it was 12:51. That's the only reason why I'm continuing. Judge: 12:51 a.m.? Cotter: yes. Judge: and that's the time that dispatch, Cotter interrupts, calls Detective McGinnis, and that's why I'm continuing it. White: we'd stipulate to that. Cotter: well, I know, but you've got to hear the tape in terms of the time when they said they called Detective McGinnis. White: trouble is, Cotter interrupts, because this is in real time. White: we're getting a whole lot of hearsay in the middle of it. The judge: but if he stipulates at 12:51 a.m., then why do we need the rest? Cotter: because you can't get a sense of the time period without listening to the actual tape and the time period of when the lady on the tape said she called McGinnis and it's 12:51. You need the time period in terms, because this is real time, to know when that first call came in. Got it? The judge: I understand your argument, but we could accomplish that by just running 11 minutes off the clock, couldn't we? Side note, it had already run for 12 minutes. Cotter: I guess. Judge: I mean, the objection is that the contents of the first reports are now in. Cotter: right. Judge: and what we're getting now is a lot of ancillary traffic related to the incident. And if the ancillary traffic is only offered for purposes of a determination that Detective McGinnis was called at 1251, Cotter, right. Judge, then I guess I don't understand why we need the rest of the material if defense is willing to stipulate to that. Cotter, if he's willing to stipulate that the first call came in at 1240. White, that was the time I heard. Cotter, I don't think they said it on the first time. They didn't say the tape. Judge, all right, so defense is willing to stipulate that the first call was at 1240 a.m. and that Detective McGinnis was dispatched at 1251. Mr. White, yes. There's so much sleight of hand going on here. First of all, like I said earlier, 1251 minus 12 does not equal 1240. So it was insane to stipulate to that time to begin with. And secondly, we have no idea how much longer we had to go to get to 1251. We didn't hear Cotter saying, "Judge, we're just a few seconds or a few minutes away," which probably would have been a valid argument to keep the tape playing. Thirdly, notice how Cotter changes Victoria's call into the first call. Listen again, quote, if he's willing to stipulate that the first call came in at 1240, end quote. And just like that, the time of the murder is established as 1240 a.m. In no small part thanks to what I think was a series of massive missteps by Jody's attorney. I cannot fathom why he allowed that tape to be played without reviewing it first. And once he did, and he finally objected, he should have asked for a recess so that he could review it before the jury was allowed to hear it. And then, the biggest mistake at all, he stipulated to the first 911 call coming in at 1240, when we know for a fact that cannot be the case. Truth and Justice is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are all things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Let me break all of that down real quick just to put a button on this. Based on the time that the tape was played, we know with 100% certainty that Victoria's call did not come in any later than 1239. That is indisputable fact. You can't argue simple math. We also know that before Victoria called, someone else had already called. And before that person called, Takamoto had searched a two-block area. And before he did that, he heard the shots and drove to that area. So even if the very next second on that tape was the 1251 announcement, that still puts the time of the murder much closer to 1230 than it does 1240. But we have no idea how much longer that tape needed to run before we were going to get to the 1251 timestamp. What we do know is that McKinney says that he was called to the scene at 12 o'clock. When he got there, McGinnis wasn't there yet. He was briefed. Then he talked to some bystanders, then he went upstairs and interviewed Victoria Miles at 12:30. We do know that Victoria said the murder happened around 11:45. In that interview, the first interview, right then, moments after it happened. We do know that James Blackwell said the murder happened around 11:45 as well. And we do know that Jody didn't leave work before 12:05. So, how did Jody get convicted? It all comes down to this game of smoke and mirrors played by McGinnis. See, we know that Jody's real alibi was being at work at Dialo's. The murder happened before midnight. We know that because McKinney was called at midnight, and Jody was signed out of work at 12:05. Simple. But Jody's attorney didn't know that. They were given a case file that didn't include the timesheet, as far as we know. It's not in the original murder book, nor is there any mention of police talking to LaShawn Harper the morning after the murder. There is an undated lead sheet where at some point someone hand-wrote that Jody was confirmed to be at work until 10 o'clock that night. But we know that Sean didn't get back from the catering job until around 10 o'clock that night. So it appears that Mr. White, Jody's lawyer, based on what was turned over to him, had no idea that Jody had been working that late. The only information that he had about Jody's work came from the reports on McGinnis's interviews that said they were home from work by 11 p.m. And that's why White didn't care about the specifics of the time of the murder. Why he stipulated to the first call coming in at 12:40. He believed, based on the police reports, that Jody was home, alone, from 11 p.m. until 3 in the morning. So it didn't matter if the murder happened at 11:45 or 12:40 or 1 a.m. It all fell into the same window. And of course, McGinnis's reports all say that the murder happened at 12:40. And why would he think that wouldn't be accurate? It didn't appear that there was any reason to shift the time since Jody was unaccounted for during that entire window. And that's how the alibi was dismantled. White was left with Sherelle as a sole alibi witness, and she was on the stand saying that the police officer was lying about what she had said a year before. The jury just didn't buy it. Here's the most disturbing part. The timesheet was removed from the murder book before it was sent to me, but I found it in the pages of the copy of the murder book that was in the prosecutor's file. That's bad today. An obvious example of why McGinnis should not have been the one handling the FOIA request for his case. But it's also bad, real bad in fact, in 2002. Art Cotter, the prosecutor in this case, had the timesheet in his possession. It was in his file. He knew Jody was at work until 12:05 and yet presented a case to the jury that Jody was home from work by 11 p.m. Think about that. He spent all that energy at trial trying to convince the jury that Jody was home long before the murder occurred when he knew for a fact that wasn't true. And this is where things get really sticky. Not only did Cotter not present the timesheet, neither did Jody's defense attorney, which means one of two things. Either Cotter turned the timesheet over in discovery as required by law, and White just missed it or decided for some reason not to use it, or it was withheld from him. If the former is true, this is an egregious case of ineffective assistance of counsel. A timesheet verified by the employer is far more powerful than a report about a witness statement regarding time. But I really don't think that's what happened here. That timesheet was a slam dunk alibi. I can't see any defense attorney disregarding it and then trying to rely on my client was home alone sleeping instead. I'm working on getting to the bottom of this as we speak, but my personal belief is that White never got the timesheet at all. And I say that for the reason I just stated, along with the fact that McGinnis clearly knew it was a problem, considering the fact that he removed it from the file before he sent it to me. When I have proof, because I have the copy of that file from the prosecutor, and the timesheet was in that original murder book. And furthermore, if it was withheld from the defense by the prosecutor, that is what is known as a Brady violation. I know that most of you know exactly what that is, but for those of you who don't, I'll explain really quickly. The prosecution is required by the Constitution of the United States to turn over all exculpatory evidence to the defense prior to the trial. They are not legally allowed to hide the, quote, bad evidence. If it's discovered after the trial that such evidence was not turned over, based on the Supreme Court ruling in the Brady versus Maryland case, the result most of the time is the conviction being overturned based on the constitutional violation. It was not a fair trial. In order to prove a Brady violation, you first have to prove that the evidence was not turned over. Then, it has to be deemed by the court to be material and exculpatory. Basically, the court has to agree that if the evidence had been turned over, it likely would have changed the outcome of trial. In this case, the jury would have learned that Jody didn't leave work until at least 12:05. That would have been confirmed by their employer. And they learned from Cornelius Simons that he gave Jody a ride home, and they sat and talked for 20 minutes after they got there, a fact that was not disputed at trial. That alone takes us to 12:30. And they would have learned that Jody went inside, argued with their girlfriend, and laid down in bed after they got home. Also facts that were not disputed at trial, which takes us well beyond even the state's fairy tale time of 12:40. I don't see how anyone can possibly dispute the fact that the timesheet would have changed the outcome of trial. If Jody couldn't have been on the scene at the time of the murder, then they couldn't have killed Mario. Which makes what you're about to hear next even more infuriating. The linchpin of the state's case against Jody was the testimony of a woman named Sonia Lucas. In 2001, Sonia lived in the downstairs apartment at 784 Broadway. She lived with her six children and her stepfather. On the night DeMario was murdered, Sonia had been hanging out with a friend and having drinks. When she got home that night, she noticed DeMario hanging around outside the building. It was between 11 and 11:30 p.m., and DeMario was alone. Sonia didn't speak to him and didn't know why he was there or for how long. She went straight inside and made herself dinner before laying down to go to sleep. She hadn't yet fallen asleep when she heard a series of gunshots outside of her door. While the shots were being fired, she heard DeMario shouting at somebody, "Man, why is you doing this?" She laid there, scared, until the shots finally ended. She then got her stepfather, who had been dozing off in the living room, to investigate. They cracked open the door to find DeMario laying right outside. Sonia spoke to him and asked if he was okay. At that point, DeMario was still alive and clearly injured. She then asked him who had done it. And then, like the scene out of a bad movie, in DeMario's final breath, he told Sonia who had shot him. Here's exactly what was said in her testimony when she was put on the stand by prosecutor Art Cotter. Cotter: "All right, you didn't go into the hallway, that right?" "No." "You said you saw him lying on the floor in the hallway?" "Yeah." "Who is he?" "DeMario." "When you looked out, could you see anybody else out there?" "No." "You said DeMario was lying in the hallway?" "Yeah." "How far from your door?" "I'd say from here to that little gray line." "Okay, that's, I don't know, about 6-7 feet, something like that, maybe a little more?" "I guess, I don't know." "Had the police gotten there yet?" "No." "When you saw DeMario, did you speak with him?" "Yes." "Was he still alive then?" "Yes." "When you spoke to him, what did you say?" "I asked him, was he all right, and he was trying to tell me yeah." "Okay, so he was still trying to talk to you at that point?" "Yes." "Could you tell if he was injured?" "Yeah, by the tone of his voice." "All right, did you see blood on him?" "No." "You indicated you asked him if he was all right, and he responded, and what did he say when he responded?" "He was trying to tell me yeah." "Was he having trouble breathing?" "Yeah." "Did you ask him anything else after that?" "I asked him who did it." "Who did it? And did DeMario say anything after that?" "Yes." "What did he say?" "He was telling me JoJo with a mouthful of blood." "How many times did he say JoJo?" "Twice." After DeMario revealed his killer's identity to Sonia, she shut the door. She was scared for herself and her children. She did not open it again until police arrived on scene, at which point DeMario was deceased. She spoke to the police that night to let them into her apartment to search for the gunman. However, she did not tell them what DeMario had told her. And as a side note, that interview and search are not included in the murder book at all, like they never happened. Afterwards, Sonia would tell police again and again that she had seen nothing that night. Over the course of 5 months, police revisited her on multiple occasions, and each time she told them the same thing. But then, on April 10th, 2002, Sonia finally told Detective Dan McGinnis about her conversation with DeMario. From the transcript. Cotter. On April 10th, 2002, Detective McGinnis spoke to you again, didn't he? Yes. And you finally told him what you had seen. I hadn't seen nothing. You didn't see anybody who actually did the shooting, correct? Yes. But you did tell him about opening up the door and talking to DeMario. Yes. And that's the first time you told him, wasn't it? Yes. End quote. In court, Sony kept saying that she, in fact, hadn't seen anything, and that's why she never told police about her conversation with DeMario. She hadn't seen the shooter, hadn't watched DeMario get shot, hadn't so much as looked out her window. Throughout Sonia's testimony, she maintains that she did not want to get involved in the case. She kept saying that the detectives did not ask her about it in the right way, and she would have told her story sooner if they had. Here's the defense attorney, White, trying to attack Sonia's credibility during cross-examination. But the first time you tell anybody about it is April 10th? Yes. Of 2002, is that right? Yes. And that's after the police had been back and forth several times talking to you? That detective? Right. Yes. What were you telling the detective before April 10th? I didn't want to get involved. You told him you didn't know anything. I didn't. You told him you never saw anything and you had no information. I didn't see anything. I was telling the truth. Well, now you're telling us something different, that you talked to this man on the floor. Is that right? Yes. But you didn't tell the police that before. I didn't tell the detective. So you were lying to the detective before? No. He asked me, did I see anything? So I wasn't lying. I was telling the truth. So you didn't consider seeing anything, this man on the floor. You don't consider that seeing something. He didn't ask me like that. Okay, so he just didn't ask you the right way? No. You would have told him if he'd asked you? Yes. End quote. So Sonia claims that the only reason she didn't reveal Mario's identification of Jody in the first several visits was because they didn't ask her the right questions. But she also said by April, she knew what the police wanted to hear, and she was tired of them coming and asking her questions. From the transcript. Quote, you knew what the police were looking for by April, didn't you? Yeah. And you wanted to get them off your back? Yeah. End quote. Sonia's reluctance to tell the police what she heard from Mario that night ended up not being an issue for the jury. They believed her story. So much so that they found it to be more important than the alibi presented by White. When you read through these transcripts, it's clear to see that Sonia was the glue that held the state's case together. Without her, there was no case against Jody. Truth and Justice is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are all things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. Sonia Lucas was the very first person that I interviewed when I began investigating this case. When I read through the case file, her story just seemed like complete nonsense to me for a few reasons. First and foremost, from what I was reading, Mario didn't know Jody Hill. So I had a hard time believing that he would identify Jody or JoJo by name. Secondly, based on his injuries, I didn't think Mario would have been able to talk at all. And most obviously, I could not fathom why a woman at home with her children would open the door seconds after hearing gunshots in the hallway. That just seemed absolutely crazy to me. And the more I read, the more suspicious I became. In the version of the original murder book that I had at that point, before Director McGinnis turned over his abridged version, there were 3 interview reports about Sonia. But it seemed like there had to be a lot more interviews than what the file was showing. Based on the language in the reports, and also because, why wasn't Sonia interviewed on the night of the murder? Mario had died right outside her door, and yet there were no reports of her being interviewed on that night. But really, it was this report that got my hackles up. Check out what McGinnis wrote in his April 10th, 2002 report. This is 5 months after the murder. Quote, "I have spoken to Lucas several times after she gave her original statement. Each time, she stated that she did not know anything and that she did not want to get involved. However, my training and experience and instincts told me that she was holding back information and was scared to come forward with any information." End quote. So I read that, and in my head, I heard,
"It must have been my sixth or even my seventh sense."
Followed by,
"I'll believe that when my shirt turns purple and smells like rainbow sherbet."
I know it's not a joking matter, but that's how outrageous this whole story seemed to me. This woman was right there when the murder happened. She was friends with Mario, and she tells police over and over a very believable story. She hid inside with her kids when she heard the shots. She didn't see anything. Then suddenly, 5 months later, Super Trooper McGinnis just knows in his gizzard that she knows something more. And that's when he figured out that, yep, with his dying breath, Mario told Sonia who killed him. JoJo did it. JoJo did it. So at that point, I was still gathering information about the case, trying to decide if I was going to move forward with it. And since Sonia was the linchpin of the state's case, I tracked her down and paid her a visit. At that point, I really had no idea what happened here, and I told her as much. I just wanted the truth.
"I'm not on anybody's team, so I just kind of want to make sure I know what the truth is about all this and get out of your hair." And so I guess just to start out, just tell me what happened, what you remember from the night that DeMario was murdered. What do you remember happening?
Me, all thing I heard was gunshot.
Okay.
Because it was by my door.
Okay.
Well, it was by, you know, I stayed downstairs, and the people that he was going to visit stayed upstairs.
Okay.
And so I don't know what happened. All thing I heard was gunshots. Me and my kids was laying in the bed. And all thing I heard was gunshots, and I got my kids out the bed, put them on the floor, and I got down on the floor. When the police arrived, they asked me all types of questions. I told them, "I don't know." They was like, "But do you know him?" I was like, "I don't even know who that is. Y'all got him covered up. How do I know?"
Uh-huh.
And they was like, "But he was laying by your door." "Okay. I stay right here."
Right. Was there only two apartments? There was just you downstairs and somebody upstairs?
Yeah. Doors.
Okay.
Dora, whatever her name is. That girl.
Mm-hmm.
She stayed upstairs. But it was an inside porch.
Okay.
So I'm like, "I don't know who that is." And then they left, and then they came back. They was like, "Can we search your house?" "Okay, search my house."
Was that the same day or another day?
The same day.
Okay.
They went outside, and then they talked, and then they came back and said, "Can we search your house?" I said, "Of course, you can search my house." They searched my house from top to the bottom, all the way to my basement. They came back up. They was like, "Well, ain't nobody here but y'all." I said, "I told y'all that when y'all knocked on my door, wasn't nobody here but me, my kids, and my stepfather."
Uh-huh.
"Oh, well, so do your stepfather know what happened? How he gonna know if we in our house shut up?"
Right. He was in there too with you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And they came back. They was like, "Well, do you know Mario Black?" Well, I was like, "Yeah." They was like, "Well, we heard that so-and-so song." "I don't know that man. Who is that? That's nobody that I hang with."
Uh-huh.
So when we went to court, I was subpoenaed to go to court. So when I got subpoenaed to go to court, I told the judge, "I don't know that man from Adam or Eve."
You talking about Joseph?
Yeah.
Okay.
She asked me, she said, "Well, who is Joseph, whatever his name is?" I'm like, I don't know that man from Adam or Eve.
Uh-huh.
He's nobody that I hang with.
Sure.
So I don't know.
And just like that, with zero prompting from me, Sonia told me what really happened that night. And it was exactly what I expected. She did the logical thing anyone would do in that situation. She got on the floor, protected her children, and didn't open the door until the police knocked on it. We also learned in those first 2 minutes of the interview that Sonia was interviewed by police on the night of the murder, and they searched her house. something that is not reported in the murder book, as I mentioned earlier. There's a reference to an original statement, but that statement doesn't exist in the case file. But most importantly, we learn that not only did she not speak to DeMario, she didn't even know that it was him who had been shot.
Eventually, there was a statement from you that that Mario had, like, said to you, JoJo did it.
No, that boy ain't told me nothing. I hadn't even spoke to that boy. Didn't even know who he was, because they had him covered up on that white sheet.
Okay, by the time you saw him?
Right. So, how am I going to tell you something?
Right.
I can't tell you nothing.
So, how did that story come about? Because I think that's what you ended up testifying to at trial, was that he had uttered this to you, that in his dying breath.
No, he didn't mean nothing.
Did,
when I seen him, that boy was dead.
Okay.
Up on the sheet.
Sonia was passionate about the fact that she never saw or spoke to Mario that night, and that she never opened the door until after the police knocked on it, at which point the body was covered up with a sheet. But as we know, she did eventually testify that Mario told her JoJo did it. So I asked her how that happened.
Was there any pressure from police or anything?
Yeah, McGinnis and that McKinney dude, whatever his name is, I can't think of his name. But yeah. And the only reason why they was messing with me, because they was looking for my son. My son was on the run at that time.
Okay.
And I wouldn't tell them where my son was.
Okay.
And while that was going on, they had caught my son.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, oh, well.
So what kind of pressure was McGinnis and was it McKinney? Was that the other one?
Yeah. They kept trying to get me to tell that I seen who did it, and Mario told me who did it. Mario ain't told me nothing, because when I seen that boy, he was covered up in my hallway. Well, in our hallway. I ain't going to say mine, because it was two apart.
Sure.
But in the hallway by my door.
Okay. So McGinnis or McKinney or both of them, they wanted you to say that you saw who did it. And they wanted you to say that he had said to you who did it.
Yeah.
Did they threaten you or anything? Or how did that?
No, they just kept on pressuring me. And I kept telling them, why is y'all still messing with me? I keep telling y'all the same thing.
So really, you kind of got dragged into this thing.
Yeah.
Who do you think drug you into it?
McGinnis and that damn McKinney dude.
Mm-hmm. They kept, so there was never any threats or anything.
They just continued to harass me, trying to get me to say that I seen him shoot Mario. I don't know who shot Mario.
Yeah.
How the fuck do I know? My bedroom made of paneling walls.
And there you have it. The story that you heard Sonia testify to at trial wasn't her story at all. It was Dan McGinnis and Blake McKinney's story. After months of harassment, Sonia finally agreed to say what they had been repeatedly telling her that they wanted her to say, so that they could convict a person that they had known since day one could not have been responsible for Mario's murder. In situations like this, I carry with me an iPad and a portable printer. I asked Sonia if she would be willing to sign an affidavit affirming everything that she had just told me in this interview. She agreed, and I reached out to a local notary and asked them to meet me at Sonia's house to notarize the affidavit right then and there. She agreed and headed our way. In the meantime, I typed up the affidavit and reviewed it with Sonia for accuracy. A copy of the affidavit will be posted on our website, but you can hear it now as I read it to Sonia before she signed it.
Okay, I'm going to read this to you one more time, and I'm going to print it, and then I'm going to wait. The notary gets off at 4, and she's going to come meet me, and we'll have to sign it, but I want to make sure this is all right for you. So, from the beginning, there's just some boilerplate. At the top says, my name's Sonia Lucas. My birthday is the information sworn in this affidavit is true, and I swear the penalty of perjury. This is my true account of what happened on the night, early morning hours of November 16, 2001, at 784 Broadway Street in Benton Harbor, Michigan, when DeMario Lowe's was shot and killed.
Yeah, apartment one.
Yeah, and I have sworn the statement on my own free will. I was not coerced, threatened, or offered any type of compensation for my sworn affidavit. So saying I didn't offer you anything for this. Mm-hmm. Yep. The statement, on the night of November 16th, 2001, I was at home in my bedroom at my apartment located at 784 Broadway in the city of Benton Harbor. I was asleep in my bed when I heard gunshots. Also in the house with me that night were my stepfather, Ellis Lewis, and my four children. I was scared when I heard the shots and stayed in my apartment. I never opened the door. No one came to my door. I did not witness the murder. I did not witness or see who shot DeMario. I did not speak to DeMario, and he did not speak to me. The first time I opened my door...
Did my phone? Hold on. Did I have phone here? I'm trying to think. Did I have phone here? Let me see. Tanisha Anthony. Pull back. I'm trying to think that I have all my keys.
It was 2001.
Oh. Yeah. See. Because it was Tanisha Anthony, Pooh Bear Earl, Yessie, and Nona.
To all six.
Mm-hmm.
They finished with this. But the first time I opened my door was after the police were on scene and DeMario was already deceased and covered up with a white sheet. I was questioned by the police a number of times. I don't remember how many times. I told the officers every time that I did not witness the murder and do not know who killed DeMario. After telling the officers this several times, Detective Dan McGinnis and Detective McKinney came to my home to interview me multiple times. Detectives McGinnis and McKinney continually pressured me to say that on the night of the murder, I opened my door and that with his dying breath, DeMario Lowe's told me that JoJo did it. This did not happen. I did not speak to DeMario at all and never saw him that night or even opened my door until the police knocked on it and DeMario was covered with a white sheet.
Right.
I did not witness the murder. I did not see who killed DeMario Lowe's, and DeMario did not say anything to me that night. I never opened my door until after the police had arrived. I swear under penalty of perjury, the statement is true and accurate. And I spelled your name wrong again here.
S-O-N-Y.
Yeah. It's in the police files. One will say, one will have a J, one will have a Y.
No, my name is Sonia.
Sonia. Okay. I'm going to pull this little printer out of here, print this thing out.
It's hard to even know what to say after that. It's hard to imagine a police officer actually actively working to frame an innocent person. And yet here we are. 23 years later, and that same police officer is still hiding the real evidence. Hiding the truth. If you've been skeptical up to this point, finding it hard to believe that a detective would leave key witness statements out of a file, that they would hide the fact that the suspect's employer alibied them, that they would ignore the timesheet and change the time of the murder, or lie in a report about the time the suspect's girlfriend said they got home, not to mention the other witnesses in the house, and pressured her to change her story? If you thought all of that sounded like conspiracy theory, after hearing from Sonia Lucas firsthand, what do you think now? Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.